Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Sam, and as always, I appreciate you joining me as we continue our trove through the big old binder of baseball cards as we are smack dab right in the middle of the 1960s. Some people will call it the second dead ball era, but some players were able to take advantage of that, including our random pull from the 1965 top set, Tony Oliva, beloved member of the Minnesota Twins organization almost since the day they relocated from Washington to Minnesota, card number 340 of the 65 top set, by the way. But as we will discuss later on in the program, Tony Oliva almost didn't become a beloved member of the Minnesota Twins organization. In fact, due to several issues and occasions, his major league career almost never got off the ground. And it's amazing that it did, and unfortunately due mostly to injuries, but a few other factors in his life, he wasn't really able to have the extended baseball career. He had a very productive baseball career, but he wasn't able to have the, you know, 22-year career, 3,000-hit, 400-home-run type career. But he had a very productive playing career. He's been a very productive coach ever since and a proud representative of the club that finally gave him a chance back in 1961. And our main topic of this podcast, of course, the 65 top set, one of my favorites, in fact, quite possibly my favorite. I'd throw in that little caveat of doubt, however, because every time I think about it, and I've had this question asked of me so many times, what's your favorite baseball card set ever? And first of all, I'm on the fence for a couple of reasons. One, I'll go, well, you know, in my lifetime, which started in 1977, I've got, you know, several choices of my favorite set. And whenever I talk about my lifetime favorite, I would say probably 95% of the time, 87 tops is the first answer that rolls out of my mouth, although sometimes I'll defer to like an 83 tops or something like that. But all time, that's where it gets tough, because obviously I'm a big fan of 87 tops, but there are some sets, as we have discovered going through the big old binder, that I absolutely love from the 1950s and 60s, and a couple from the early 70s, too. We'll get to those in the next few weeks. But 65 tops, ever since I've been a teenager and I started collecting the vintage cards, there's just something about the design. There's something about the look. There's something about the feel. There's something about the photography. And as we get into some of the minutiae of the set, there's just something about 65 tops that keeps putting itself at the top of the heap, and you'll see why. And if you're not a big fan of 65 tops, or maybe you haven't been exposed to it up until this point in time, I think it's a set that is well worth your time in exploring and investing in, not just money, but time too. You know, that's part of the equation. People automatically think of money with baseball cards, but you also need time to build out that set and collect what really inspires you to keep on collecting. So we'll talk about that after we talk about what you're talking about at our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains. And a lot of interesting discussions this week, talking a little bit about our previous podcast on 64 tops, and in particular, the Houston Colt 45s, but also a little conversation about our Flashback Friday episode featuring 89 tops, which is one of my favorites as well. Of course, if you listen to that podcast, you know I have a personal reason for liking that set so much. That was the first set I was exposed to get my baseball card collecting going when I was a youngster. And it is still a popular set for collectors these days. We'll talk about that in a moment, but I want to go back to a comment on our 64 Tops podcast and our random pull, which was Rusty Staub. It was a first-year card for him with the Houston Colt 45s. And part of our podcast, I went through the history not only of Rusty Staub, but also the Houston Colt 45s, who, of course, later became the Astros. And one part of the Colt 45 history that often gets left by the wayside is the story of Colt Stadium, which was just, you know, the ultimate temporary stadium in the pantheon of temporary stadiums. And some baseball stadiums are more temporary than others. Some are more permanent than others. Just ask the people in Montreal with Jarry Park. Or in Toronto, Exhibition Stadium was there far longer than I'm sure the Blue Jays initially intended on playing in a small football slash exhibition stadium that they made into a baseball stadium. But Colt Stadium was definitely that, where it was rickety wooden bleachers. You had folding chairs everywhere. And most importantly, it was pretty much 100% uncovered. So if you were going to a Houston Colt 45s game back in 1962 through 64, you were not only treated to some pretty bad baseball over those years, but also you had the heat, you had the humidity, and notably the Texas-sized mosquitoes that were just coming in and just doing all sorts of damage to the people watching the games. And our friend Sleep Frank out in San Diego comments, "I dig the old park talk. Fleer and the Junk Wax time used to put old parks on the back of the stickers. So cool." And yeah, I remember that. I think it was 88 Fleer. And I always liked the Fleer sticker sets, or not really the sets, you know, the stickers that came in the wax packs. Because as I've mentioned before, anything with a Major League logo on it, I'm all for, you know, putting it in sticker form and just sticking those things everywhere. And I used to, you know, when I collected big time, you know, back in the late 80s and early 90s, anytime I got a Fleer pack, those stickers ended up, if not on a card box or a card folder, they ended up pretty much anywhere, you know, a bedpost, a book cover at school, a car bumper. You know, they ended up everywhere. And I do recall the 88 set, if you flip the sticker card on its backside, it wasn't all the stickers, because I think some of the stickers just had like team trivia, but the stickers that featured just one logo, because Fleer had two different types of sticker sets. You had the one logo, and then you had a sticker card with four little circular logos on it. Well, the cards that had one logo, if you flip the card over, it also showed the stadium. And I think it just had like the dimensions and the capacity of the stadium of the team featured on the front. So that was a neat way. And again, this being the late 1980s, there were still a lot of older stadiums still in commission back then. Talking about Texas Rangers, the old Arlington Stadium. You had the Kingdome in Seattle, Jack Murphy Stadium in San Diego, Candlestick Park in San Francisco, Shea Stadium in New York, Olympic Stadium in Montreal. The Jays were still an exhibition stadium in 1988, so that was featured. So you not only had the classics of old Yankee Stadium, Fenway Park, Wrigley Field, the old Comiskey Park, but you also had some of the, let's just say, transitional stadiums, all of the concrete ashtray stadiums that were built in the 60s in Atlanta and Cincinnati and St. Louis and Philadelphia and Pittsburgh. They were all on there as well. So that's a neat little memory there. And I love talking about some of the old stadiums, too, because even if I was never at some of those stadiums, I actually have been to a couple of the stadiums prior to their demolition, Shea Stadium, the old Yankee Stadium as well. In Turner Field, you know, now that's a former ballpark, believe it or not. But, you know, it's I guess it's because there was some simplicity to some of these older ballparks that you don't see these days. You know, ever since Camden Yards was opened in 1992, major league teams have really tried to recreate a lot of the 1940s and 50s ballparks. Some have had some success, others not so much, because while there's a desire to recreate a look and feel of an older ballpark, you also have to stay modern in the amenities. And ballparks, especially now with millennials and with attendees, you know, walking around with cell phones all the time, you have to create these neat little niches within the ballpark. So the ballpark is now continuously evolving year after year, as opposed to generation to generation. Well, you didn't have that, you know, especially in a stadium like, you know, Colt Stadium in Houston. But a lot of the older ballparks, the main attraction was, amazingly, the baseball game. That was about it. So it's kind of fun to look back at some of these older stadiums. And in fact, you know, when you look at Tony Oliva and the Minnesota Twins, you know, playing in the old Metropolitan Stadium, which if you listen to our 1961 Tops podcast with Ted Bosefield, we went through the whole story of how the Angels and the new Senators and then the Minnesota Twins were created. So what was then a very large minor league stadium built in the late 1950s that became a major league stadium, by the 1970s, the late 70s, it became this hulking metal mess because the Vikings had moved in. And of course, having to deal with the harsh Minnesota winters, the stadium did not fare too well. And by its end in 1981, before the Metrodome opened up, from what I've read, Metropolitan Stadium was just a safety hazard that just happened to house an NFL and a major league team. And also an NASL team, too. I forgot the Minnesota, the Kicks, I think, was their team. They played at the old Metropolitan Stadium as well. So it's kind of neat to look back, as flawed as some of these stadiums were, to kind of look back at some of them and the history and the team history that they brought with them. Moving on to another comment, actually Sleep Frank forwarded a comment from Ryan Cracknell, who's a writer for Beckett.com and follows this podcast. He sent out a tweet. Yes, there was a Rusty Kuntz bobblehead given out by the Royals a couple weeks ago. And he's got this great picture of Rusty Kuntz, and it's just kind of your standard bobblehead, although Rusty Kuntz has this incredible flow going on with his hair. I'm somebody who is practically bald, so I'm jealous at pretty much anyone who can actually style hair. But it's a thing of beauty, and of course, the inside joke, and all of us baseball card collectors, especially those of us who were alive and collecting in the 80s, we all remember Rusty Kuntz, K-U-N-T-Z, and the numerous unfortunate times Rusty Kuntz's nickname was mispronounced into something that rhymes with dunce. To the tweet that Ryan sent out, I said, I am still waiting for my Pete LeCocq bobblehead. And Pete LeCocq was another Royals product. He played for several teams in his career, but more than enough giggles emanated from certainly my bedroom or any of my friends' houses when we were, you know, going through the baseball cards from the early 80s. And you would pull a Pete LeCocq and a Rusty Kuntz, and you would just double over laughing. So some great early 80s collecting memories going on there. Speaking of 80s collecting memories, as I mentioned, the Flashback Friday episode, looking back at our podcast from several months ago on 89 Tops, a set that is still popular with collectors for a number of reasons. Of course, there's still quite literally 4 million copies of each card out there, so it's not for value purposes. But a lot of the big stars from the 1990s had first-year cards or rookie cards in the 89 Topps set. Of course, Ken Griffey Jr. was the biggest one there, but you also had other players like Tom Glavine and John Smoltz and Craig Biggio, all sorts of players who were stars in the early 90s, and some Hall of Fame players as well, but also some of the big stars from the 1980s. You had Ripken and Sandberg and Henderson and all those guys. Well, one, of course, was Kirby Puckett. In 1989, Puckett was in the major leagues for about 5 years, had already really started blazing a tremendous path in his career. And Eric Eller sends us a scan of one of his favorite players, but not necessarily one of his favorite cards. He says, got 89 factory set for Christmas. I was so pumped until I saw Kirby's card. And Eric mentions he is a Twins fan. How was this the best photo they had? Good set otherwise. And I totally forgot about this card. And again, you can look at it on our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains, or just, you know, do a Google Images search, 89 Tops Kirby Puckett. And it is Kirby Puckett looking like, I'm not really sure, A, stoned off his gourd, B, waking up after a very long bender, or C, perhaps listening to an economics professor talk about accounting or something. He just really looks like he's half awake and not really connected with this world here. And you have to wonder because, you know, like I said, Puckett was around for several years. You'd think the Topps people would have a ton of pictures, especially action shots. And for some reason, somebody in the editor's office went, that'll do. The one where Kirby's just kind of staring off at the ground. That'll definitely be a star photograph of one of our star players here. So, yeah, it is a little bit of a head scratcher there. And thank you for sharing that with us, Eric. Thanks to everybody who shares anything with our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains. It's open 24/7. If you want to talk about our podcast, about the sets we talk about, the players we talk about, or anything about the hobby in general, we encourage your commentary And it's always fun to follow us and just kind of see where the commentary is going. Because some weeks it's really talkative. You've got people talking about those podcasts or the particular sets we're talking about. And then some weeks it's a little quieter, but the people who do chime in bring in some real gems, like a Rusty Coons bobblehead. So again, Wax and Gum Stains on Twitter. Please share that handle with all of your collecting friends, either people who collected back in the day or who still do now. We've got a lot of fun stories to share there. And also make sure you pass on the word that Wax Ecstatic can be heard twice a week, new episodes on Tuesday. We continue to go through the big old binder, 1965 tops this week. We'll look at 1966 next week. And of course, we always have the Flashback Friday episodes. We have almost 80 episodes now that we've done. And it's nice to allow people to catch up to some of the older episodes. You've got plenty to listen to. So we will spotlight one of our older episodes. Again, 89 tops was the last one we looked at. Who knows which one will be re-released, if you will, on Friday. But if you follow us at Wax and Gum Stains, you'll be able to find that out. And of course, Wax Ecstatic is available on a number of platforms. Audio Boom is our home plate, but you can also hear us on iHeartRadio, iTunes, TuneIn, and Stitcher. And it's not just news shows, it's archives as well. So whatever app you prefer to listen to, whichever website you prefer to listen to while you're at work, you've got plenty of options there. And of course, we always post a link to our Audio Boom stream of a podcast on the Wax and Gum Stains Twitter feed. So even if you don't necessarily follow one platform over the other, if you follow us on Twitter, you will get the shows sent directly to you. The new shows every Tuesday and the links to the archive shows, the Flashback Friday shows every weekend. All right, let's flash back to 1965. Again, one of my favorite sets of all time, 65 tops, just has that look, just has that feel, and is also a pretty easy set for people to collect because this wasn't like 89 tops where there were millions of each card that were produced. But by this point in time, you started having people collecting cards, not just for the bubblegum, but because there were pictures and stats of their favorite baseball players here. So the card collecting hobby had changed a little bit compared to, say, 1955. This was something that you could collect and you know, put into a shoebox and strap a rubber band around. It was becoming more and more of a collector's item and less something that happened to come in a wax package along with a piece of bubble gum. And 65 tops, I think, really captures some of the creativity, some of the dominance that baseball had at the time, and some of the great players that were coming into the game. Now, if you really like rookie cards, 65 tops is one of the best sets that you can get your hands on. You know, 64 tops didn't really have any big rookies. You know, Phil Niekro was probably the biggest true rookie card. You had the second year card of Pete Rose, which many people kind of look at as a rookie card because it's his first solo card. But in 65, they really, really made up for a lack of rookies in 64. The biggest one, Steve Carlton, also Joe Morgan in there, Tony Perez, the late Jim Catfish Hunter, some other notable names, Burt Campaneris, Louis Tiant, Denny McClain, Tug McGraw, Tony Oliva, and also if you're into rarities, the first Japanese Major League Baseball player, his rookie card is in here, and that would be Masanori Murakami. So a neat little thing there. But 598 cards with a lot of rookies, with a lot of second and third year cards for players like Pete Rose or Rusty Staub, as the case may be, from our 64 Tops podcast. And also, you still have a generation of star players like Mickey Mantle, even though his career was in a decline then. You had Hank Aaron. You had Carl Yastrzemski. You had all sorts of stars and rookies and just a tremendous crop of talent here as Major League Baseball's expansion dust settled a little bit. And, you know, before things got watered down with the major expansion in 1969, you had a really good crop of talent coming up here in 1965. Now, one of the biggest reasons why I like this set, other than the fact it's easy to attain and you've got lots of great rookies, but the design is one of the best in the history of Topps baseball cards, in my opinion. Let's take a look at our random pull card number 340 here, Tony Oliva. As we've got Oliva in his batting stance, a stance that would rack up quite a few points in his career. His career batting average was only 304. Hard to believe this guy's not in the Hall of Fame. We'll get to that in a little bit. But here he is in his batting stance, likely at Yankee Stadium here. You've got about 85% of the card dedicated to the photo, using kind of that same Kodachrome processing that we saw first in 57 Tops, but you'd see throughout future years. So you had some pretty good photographs that came with this set. You also have, in the case of Oliva, you've got the All-Star Rookie Trophy. Now, this is an uncorrected error, not just with the Oliva card, but I've done a little searching through other cards featured in the 1965 set. If you look closely at the inscription on the trophy, it says Tops 1963 All-Star Rookie. Should say 1964, but I've looked at several other cards that fall into this category, and they all say 1963. So while Topps was utilizing this rookie trophy more and more in their sets, again, this was kind of an early edition of prospect cards or labeling a card a star rookie or a rookie card. Topps forgot to change the year. So that's something that notably stands out, other than the fact that, much like the Rusty Staub card we looked at in 64 Topps, the trophy on here is just ginormous, although I think it is a little smaller on this card than what we saw on the Rusty Staub card. Now, the bottom third of the card, you have the player's position and his name, along with a color corresponding tint to it. It varied from card to card, but here in the Oliva case, it's purple. If you had an Athletics card, it was green. If you had a Reds card, it was red. You know, they tried to coordinate the color of the inside border along with the team. And then you have one of my favorite features of the 65 top set, and this is something that stuck out to me for years. I've always liked this. And that is the little waving pennant flag with the team name and team crest on it. And I say crest because it's not necessarily the logo. You know, you think Minnesota Twins 1965, you're thinking of the Twin Cities cap logo, which the Twins, and I love this, went back to recently with their uniforms sometime in the last few years. You think of the, you know, Twins kind of Dodgers-esque script that was on the front of their jerseys, which, again, the Twins went back to a few years ago. But no, you actually have, it's almost like the team seal that is featured on this pennant. And not only does it just kind of look cool on the card, but, you know, I'm somebody who has always liked pennants, not just in baseball, really any sport. And I have a small collection of some pennants from the 60s and 70s at my house. Don't know what to do with them. I don't have any place to display them now. But they are nice and cozy in some bedroom closet somewhere. But I've always liked the pennant look. And again, the crest, it just had this really classy look to it. And it kind of adds that baseball fan element to it. It adds this little fun element, much like 89 Tops. And I said this in that podcast where, you know, the team name in the script and the player name written on the tail of the team name, you'll kind of have that quote unquote all American baseball feel to it. That's what the pennant flag does for me. And I've always, always liked that. This card is just a winner in a design. It's also fairly easy to maintain the set because even though there's quite a bit of white border here, even though these cards have some wear and tear, and certainly this particular card does, it still holds up well. It actually looks better than it is condition-wise. And this particular card, I remember buying, I want to say it was at a card show some 25 years ago, and I bought it because it was in the condition it was, so I was able to buy it for like 50 cents or something ridiculous like that. I remember buying this because I saw this card featured in a Beckett price guide. And remember, in 1991, 92, whenever it was, this is pre-internet. So this was the only way that I could see these cards back then was through the Beckett price guide. And then if I went out and bought some cards, then I could actually see and hold and feel, a relic from 1965. So Tony Oliva's card was featured in the price listing for a few months, and Beckett would change him out every now and then. So I saw this, and I had read about Tony Oliva and how tremendous of a player he was. And I think the rookie card back then was worth maybe $50, but again, in the condition that this was in, I got it for like 50 cents. And it's been treasured ever since because it is a very cool card, the beginning of a great career. This was not the first 65 Topps card I ever had. If I recall, the first one that I got was a journeyman relief pitcher. His name was Ron Pache. And let's see if I can remember. His 65 Topps card was an Angels card. So you had the old, and this was when they were still the LA Angels. This was the last year the Angels were known as the LA Angels before they became the California Angels. But Pache was a member of the Milwaukee Braves the year before. So he was traded during the offseason. So you had the classic player without a hat shot here. And you know, Pache had this Buzz Aldrin buzz cut going on, as did a lot of people in the mid 60s. And I remember that card, even though Ron Pache was just this, you know, average run of the mill pitcher. I always liked the look of that card. And again, having this little neat connection to a Milwaukee Brave who is now playing with an LA Angel, which is something that you wouldn't ever see again. Now, I know the Angels are the Los Angeles Angels of Anaheim. Technically, they're Anaheim. But, you know, the original LA Angels, it was kind of neat to have that. And that card came in a lot of cards that I bought at a flea market, again, early 90s. I think it was probably in the same lot that the Frank Howard card I had in the 63 Topps podcast came from. And it was just a neat-looking card, and I think I fell in love with 65 Topps ever since then. So, you know, I've had this long-time connection to 65 Topps. I love it, and a lot of it is the design elements on the front of the card. But also, the design elements on the back of the card. This just has a really, really neat construction to it. And if you flip the card over, you see the one thing that really caught me. And again, you know, I didn't see a 65 Topps card in my hand until I was like 12 or 13 years old. The color on here, and the color is a little faded on this one, but it has that cool dark blue color to it. This is the same cool dark blue that I talked about in 88 Donruss and 91 Donruss. The backs of those cards had that same color to it. And I don't know what it is about that color. Maybe it's just me, but I've always been attracted to this kind of color of blue. It is just a really nice color. Kind of has a minty fresh look to it. Not that I would encourage you to smell or lick these cards looking for a minty fresh break, but it just had that look to it. And I don't know, maybe it's in the case of a player from Minnesota having this wintry, cool color to it. Just, I don't know, it just works. But I've always liked the back of the 65 Topps cards because of the color on here. If you look at the back, you have the card number and Topps logo upper left-hand corner. You would have, for most players, if their career was not very long, you would have a cartoon tidbit at the top. And here you have, it says Tony Oliva. Tony led the Appalachian League in hits and RBI in 1961. So you have this really goofy cartoon of a very pale Tony Oliva holding up two crowns. But it was also neat that the player names were written in this kind of comic book, you know, Raiders of the Lost Ark font. You know, that kind of played off real well, too. Now, because Oliva's career at this time was not very long, you have a nice little bio talking about his tremendous Rookie of the Year season in 1964, and then the complete major and minor league batting record. So you have this very different look. Even though Topps was starting to get a little more uniform with the backs of their cards, you know, the backs were presented horizontally. You had the complete major minor league batting records or pitching records for a pitcher. You had limited space for biotechs, limited space for cartoons and little tidbits. But in 65, they just kind of went the comic book route. And I know some collectors don't like that. Some people look at it as Comic Sans. You know, it's one reason why some people don't like 87 Topps, because you had kind of the Sharpie marker effect of the player's name written at the bottom of the card. Some people don't like that. But I like this. This is very different. And compared to the very business 1964 Topps set, and we talked about this in the podcast last week, where you had, you know, a lot of straight lines, big block letters, big square pieces to the card, 65 Tops was a lot more fun looking. And I like kind of that back and forth that Tops had in 64 going to 65, and as we would see later, 65 going into 66. So the 65 Tops set, in my opinion, just has it's the whole enchilada. You've got a great design. You've got a fun design. You've got great pictures. You've got great rookies and all-stars and, you know, first and second year cards and established veterans in this set. You've got a lot of, neat little insets, the all-star cards that were thrown in there, World Series highlight cards. And then when you flip the cards over on the back, you've got that cool color on the back, the unique stats that were thrown in there in stories. And like I said, that Raiders of the Lost Ark font that had the player name at the top. It was pretty neat. So this is just the many reasons why I like 65 Tops. I know some people are a little different. If you don't like it as much, feel free to share your thoughts at Wax and Gum Stains, but it's just the complete package. It really is. It's a fun set. It's easy to collect. It holds up well through the wear and tear of, 50 plus years later. You've got a great assortment of rookies and star cards and even the average player cards. Like I said, a guy like Ron Pichet, I mean, that is not a household name for baseball fans, unless you're in Milwaukee or Los Angeles, you may know who he is. But, even the average player looked good on this card. And 65 Tops is one of the big reasons why I got back into the hobby a few years ago. And again, the biggest reason was my son, who I was, just on a whim, just bought a few packs of cards. Hey, let's see if we can get him to start collecting. And he likes sports and really loves baseball, so it was an easy connection there. But 65 Tops, that was the template for 2014 Tops Heritage. And because I loved 65 Tops so much, I bought a lot of 2014 Tops Heritage. And that really kept me going. Even though I'm not a huge fan of the 66 and 67 Tops designs, I still bought a lot of 2015 and 2016 Topps Heritage cards. Just ask my wife. There's still too many of them around the house. Another neat thing about the 65 Topps set, the add-ons to the sets. We mentioned in 64 Topps, there were coins. 63 Topps, you had stickers. One was the iron-on, or as it was called, an iron-on transfer, which is, as it sounds, it's basically a cartoon character of some of the biggest stars in the major leagues back then, and you could iron it on to your favorite t-shirt or whatever. So there's that, but there's also something called Topps Embossed. In many ways, this was kind of like the stamped cards. What was the car company called? Action Packed, I think is what it was. You saw these in the late 80s and early 90s where, the player body or the player's head on the card was kind of pushed up a little bit. That's basically what you had. And of course, you had the main star players of 1965 that had an embossed card. So there's 72 embossed cards. There's 72 iron-on transfers. And compared to some of the coins, where I think there were 200 of them in 64, you only had 72 of each of these. So it was a much more manageable insert to collect. So if you're looking for not just the set, but all the other bells and whistles that come with it, then this is a pretty good one to go searching after. So a winning design, a great collection of players, a very collector-friendly design where even through some wear and tear, it doesn't show its age real well. And also, again, availability, because baseball was growing a little more in the mid-1960s. You have more and more of these cards available. This is a reason why I love 65 Tops, or these are all the reasons, I should say. And all the reasons why, again, if you haven't been exposed to 65 Tops or you've never really put any time or effort into it, I strongly suggest look into it, because I think, just like any other vintage card we talk about here, even if you get a lot of just 20 or 30 cards for a few dollars and they're not in great condition, I think you'll really, really enjoy this set. If you don't, I'd be curious to hear why. So again, at Wax and Gum Stains on Twitter, I'd be curious to hear your reasons why you love or you hate the 65 Tops set. I can tell you, though, 64 Tops, again, wasn't one of those sets where you either love it or hate it. There's a gray area there, and I've grown to like it over the years. But 65 Tops, this is a set that very few collectors I know dislike. There's a lot of reasons why you like it. I haven't heard too many people dislike it. So again, if you do, I'd be curious to hear what it is, but I think probably 95% of the collectors out there who have dabbled in some of the vintage cards from the 1960s, 65 tops is a set that they love to collect for all the reasons that I laid out there. Now, the Tony Oliva story, this is just an incredible story. As I mentioned, Oliva, much beloved by Minnesota Twins fans, part of the Twins' early success in the 1960s, along with Harmon Killebrew, later Zolo Versailles, and also Rod Carew. You had a very successful contending Twins team for much of the 1960s. Of course, they won the American League pennant in 1965, took the Dodgers to 7 games. And that was quite the feat, as the Dodgers, although they were not as dominant as they were in the late 50s and early 60s, were still a force to reckon. The Twins were able to push them to the brink. And it was a team that helped keep Twins fans, well, it helped keep their hopes alive for many, many years in the 70s and early 80s, because there was about a 15-year stretch where the Twins were not very good. And, you know, this team from the 1960s, or the teams from the 1960s, really kept things going in the right direction for Minnesota fans. And they were treated, even though this was essentially the old Washington Senators, thanks to the Senators' scouting department tracking down some very talented players in the late 1950s, they were able to assemble a pretty good team going into the early 60s. So the Minnesota fans who were longing for Major League Baseball ever since Horace Stoneham and the Minneapolis Millers teased them for many years with that ginormous Metropolitan Stadium before Stoneham moved the Giants to San Francisco, they were treated with a pretty good product for certainly the decade of the 1960s, and it got them through the next 15 to 20 years before the Twins actually became world champions. Well, Tony Oliva was one of those players who help keep the faith not only in the 60s, but many, many years afterwards. He was really not the first Cuban-born player to be a big star, but the first to come up through the ranks and really take Major League Baseball by storm. Of course, you had guys like Orlando Cepeda, who, you know, garnered plenty of, you know, spotlights and headlines for good reason. But, you know, Oliva was really, and especially post-Castro Cuba, was really one of the big names in Major League Baseball that really opened the floodgates for a lot of Cuban-born players. Like I said, he wasn't the first. You had Cepeda, you had Minnie Minoso, but really this guy kind of set the stage for a lot of players to come up through the Major League ranks in the 1960s and 70s. And the amazing story is he almost didn't make it. First of all, because of some circumstances beyond his control, but also because the Twins at first did not have a lot of faith in him. So you look back at the time of Tony Oliva, again, growing up on a farm in Cuba, one of 10 children. Well, his dad creates a little baseball diamond on the farm. And much like you would hear about in southern towns or even some western towns in America, where you had these sandlot games, and that's where some major league stars were scouted and discovered. The same thing happened here, where the neighborhood ball players would come together, and word started getting out about this kid, Tony Oliva. And he was just smacking the cover off the ball here, and some scouts were able to get down to Cuba and check it out. Now, timing was rather fortunate for Oliva, because again, this was right after the Castro takeover in 1959. This was right around the Bay of Pigs invasion in 1961. He was scouted by Minnesota's Joe Cambria, who was responsible for a lot of the young talent that came up through the pipeline in the late 50s and early 60s for the Senators slash Twins. And Oliva was scouted out by Cambria, signed to a deal, and it looked like Oliva was going to be able to escape Cuba, get into America, and start his way up the pipeline into the major leagues. Well, long story short, he didn't have a birth certificate, so he borrowed his older brother's birth certificate. So there was some confusion on what Oliva's name was, although he and his older brother amazingly had the same birthday. It was just 3 years apart. By using his brother's birth certificate, he was able to get the paperwork to come over to the States. But it wasn't a direct shot from Cuba to America. Again, remember the Cuban Bay of Pigs invasion, the Castro takeover from a couple years before, tensions were very, very, very high and very, very tight between these two nations. So he and a collection of other Cuban-born players have to go to Mexico. As more paperwork is getting worked out, he then finally makes his way to a Twins training camp in Fernandina Beach, Florida. But the training camp is running out of time. There's only a handful of games left on the schedule. Here's a guy that, you know, has been in transit for a couple of weeks, so now he's getting thrust into a tryout. And on top of that, because Oliva is a dark-skinned Cuban, he got lumped into a group of African-American players. Now, if you don't know where Fernandina Beach, Florida is, it's just south of Jacksonville. It's near St. Augustine. And in 1961, let me put it nicely, race relations were not very good in this particular section of not only the state of Florida, but certainly the United States. So he had trouble adjusting to the norms. He had trouble finding places to stay, finding places to eat. His world was getting turned upside down here. What should have been a great opportunity for him was just getting turned, again, upside down and backwards. And it just was not an easy path for him. So he had a very lackluster tryout. So lackluster that the Twins were not impressed. He didn't hit as well as the scouting report said. He was a terrible fielder. He was not very good at fielding early on in his career. And they cut him loose. So he was prepared to go back to Cuba. But Cambria was able to talk some of the people within the organization. You've got to keep this kid. And not just Oliva, but there were a couple others who were in his group that Cambria really went to bat for. And thankfully for Oliva, and certainly Cambria, as this was a nice feather in his cap, the Twins said, all right, we'll keep him. We've got to find a place for him to go, though, because a lot of the Twins' farm clubs were in the deep south. There was a limit of black players that you could have on a team. You didn't want to cause any kind of race relations issues with the teams and the cities that they played in. So they did a little shuffling, and they finally find a place for him in Wytheville, Virginia, which is still very much in the deep south. So Oliva goes to Wytheville, Virginia, and just has a tremendous rookie season in 1961. And he is clearly getting the attention of the staff and management of the Minnesota Twins organization. They go, whoa, all right, this kid's pretty good. So much so that they invited him to a September tryout in their camp in St. Petersburg, part of their instructional league. And also going into 1962, the Twins decided to protect him, moving him up to the 40-man roster, which was quite the move there because, again, in 1962, with the expansion draft, the Twins had to expose some players. They did not want to lose him. Now, he bounces around in the minor leagues a little bit, starts the season in Vancouver, eventually goes down to Class A Charlotte. Vancouver was a Triple-A team, by the way. So he's demoted a little bit, but it actually helps his career out. And he gets a cup of coffee in September 1962, plays in a handful of games with Minnesota. Going into 1963, Tony's feeling pretty good about himself, thinks he's going to make the major league squad, but he starts the season in AAA. This time the Twins farm club is in Dallas-Fort Worth, and Oliva is pissed. He thinks, I'm a better player than this. I've had my taste of the major leagues. You know, I've been assigned a major league number. I've got a locker stall in spring training. I should be getting, you know, a little better treatment than this. And he actually considers just going back to Cuba. He thinks he's just going to get up and go and leave. Well, fortunately for Oliva, and especially the Twins, Vic Power and Zolio Versailles talk him out of it. And they say, hey, man, you got to stay here. You're going to get your chance. And Oliva would stay in AAA, improve his craft even more. And of course, later he would admit that it was a good thing that he did stick around. Got another cup of coffee at the end of the 1963 season. And then 1964, he starts in Minnesota. And the rest, as they say, is history. 1964 wins the Rookie of the Year award. He's an all-star. In fact, the first of eight consecutive all-star appearances for Oliva. He finished fourth in the American League MVP vote. And here's why. He appeared in 161 games, 217 base hits, scored 109 runs, had 43 doubles and a batting average of 323. Had 374 total bases. All those stats I gave you, oh, by the way, led the American League. And no surprise, the following year when the Twins win the pennant and take the Dodgers to seven games, Oliva has another banner year, is actually the runner-up behind his teammate, Versailles. Has a 321 batting average, 185 hits, and the hits quite literally would keep on coming. As I mentioned, numerous all-star appearances, the Twins barely missing the playoffs in 1967. They would make the playoffs in 1969 and 70, losing to Baltimore in both seasons. And by the way, even though his fielding was not very good early on, he was able to improve on that and was actually a Gold Glove outfielder in 1966. Now, what robbed Oliva of a more productive career? A couple things. First of all, the starts and stops at the beginning of his career. He didn't become a regular major league ball player until he was, allegedly, 25 years old. And this is, again, if you're assuming he truly was born in 1938. But 25 years of age is when he made his, you know, his permanent inroads into the major leagues, which was later than a lot of players at that time. But also, he started to deal with a lot of knee injuries. And especially in 1971, dealt with an off-season surgical procedure that did not work real well, had limited appearances in spring training, and had to go under the knife again in 1972, where he played only 10 games that season. Tony Oliva was a benefactor of the new designated hitter rule because that basically saved his career. He didn't have to do the wear and tear of running out in the outfield. So mostly as a designated hitter from 1973 through the end of his career in 1976, playing the role of DH, but still putting up some very, very impressive numbers. Batting average of 291, 285, 270 in 73, 74, and 75. Appeared in only 67 games in 1976, but was starting to make the transition from player to coach. And from 1976 on, he had something to do with the Twins organization. He was a first base coach. He was a hitting coach. He was a minor league instructor. He is still an ambassador to the Minnesota Twins all these years later. And when he officially hung up the cleats after the 1976 season, only 15 years in Major League Baseball, only 1,676 games, but again, a 304 batting average, an on-base percentage of 353, 220 home runs. You know, he wasn't really known for his power, and there were some rather spacious parts of Metropolitan Stadium. So he was more of a contact hitter, but he could put the ball over the fence if need be. Best known, however, just for getting on base and especially doubles. 329 doubles in his career, led the American League in that category four times, and he led the American League in just hits five times. He finished his career with 1,917. And even though Oliva did not win a World Series as a player, he did win as a member of the Minnesota Twins organization as a coach. He was the hitting coach in 1987, bench coach in 1991. And like I said, he is still very active in the Minnesota Twins organization to this day. They retired his number six back in 1991. He was also honored with a statue at the new Target Field prior to the 2011 home opener. He is also a member of the Minnesota Twins Hall of Fame. And all you Twins fans who love and remember the late Kirby Puckett to this day, Tony Oliva played a huge part in helping Puckett adjust his batting style to the major leagues. And he really helped set up Puckett for a lot of success throughout the 1980s and early 1990s. So there you go. Tony Oliva, a guy who, despite having a career batting average of 304 and all of these, you know, leading the league in hits and doubles and an impressive number of home runs, and despite some lackluster defense early in his career, was actually a Gold Glove winner, eight-time All-Star, two-time runner-up to the MVP. I almost forgot about that. He also finished second in the MVP voting in 1970. You know, this was a guy that could just absolutely dominate in the game for a very short amount of time. Despite this, he is not in the Baseball Hall of Fame, and that is an absolute crime. You know, he's unfortunately one of those guys that kind of falls on the borderline, you know, especially when you look at players that he is similar to in career numbers. But again, it was a career that was cut short due to injuries, also a late start, and a little bit of a lack of faith in the Twins very early on. And again, thanks to Joe Cambria really sticking his neck out in the spring of 1961, Oliva was able to make inroads in the major leagues, and the Minnesota Twins were able to benefit from that back then. And they still do now. Like I said, still very active and much beloved in Minnesota Twins history. And because he doesn't have 2,000 or 3,000 hits, and he doesn't have 400 home runs, and he didn't win an MVP award or, didn't win four or five World Series as a player, unfortunately, not only is Oliva not in the Hall of Fame, but he's kind of fell by the wayside in the history of the game. And I really hope more and more people take note of what Oliva has done, certainly on the field during his playing time, but off the field, so influential to so many Minnesota Twins players over the last 40 years. And from all accounts, a pretty good guy, too. And having to deal with, you know, the language barrier, the cultural barrier, discovering upon his shock that because he was a dark-skinned Cuban, everybody just thought he was black, so he had to deal with the racial injustices in the South in the early 1960s. This guy deserves to be in Cooperstown, and I really hope that the next time the Veterans Committee makes a vote, they really give some serious consideration to Tony Oliva. He absolutely deserves that honor. And again, you know, he's not the 3,000 hit club. He's not the 400 home run club. You know, the old benchmarks that used to mean automatic induction. But he really, really deserves some consideration. And I hope that he can find that sooner than later. So there you go. Tony Oliva, card number 340 of the 1965 top set. One of my absolute favorites. Again, not just because of the players that are available, but it's just an outstanding design. It's a fun design. It's a nice break from some of the really stiff designs that Topps had, certainly in 1964, but earlier in the decade. And it's a really fun set to collect. Even the common cards are neat to look at and learn a thing or two from. So again, if you haven't really been exposed to 65 Topps before, haven't really cared, put in a little time and money and get just a small lot of beat up 65 Topps cards and look through them. I guarantee you you'll have a good time doing so and a nice appreciation for the set moving forward. Well, we're going to move forward. We've got a Flashback Friday episode coming this upcoming weekend. To find out more about that, make sure you follow us on Twitter at Wax and Gum Stains. And then next Tuesday, we take a look at the 1966 top set. Much like the 64 top set, I slowly grew into appreciation of this set, but especially compared to 1965, it lacks a little bit. And in fact, it falls into that same boat as 88 Topps, coming off a banner year with that epic 87 release. 88 Topps had a lot of good things, but fell kind of short. Same thing with 66 Topps, but still some very good things about that set. And we'll do a random pull from our big old binder as well. That's coming next Tuesday via Audioboom, iTunes, iHeartRadio, Stitcher, and TuneIn. I'm Matt Salmon, your host of Wax Ecstatic. Thank you so much for listening, and make sure you show us your things with a little token or two of your appreciation by sending us a tip at our tip jar at paypal.me/waxecstatic. We'll see you next Tuesday for a new episode of Wax Ecstatic. Thanks again for joining us.